Ezekiel chapters 1 through basically almost the end of chapter 3 is Ezekiel's call to prophetic ministry. And there's a literary genre or literary form in the Old Testament which is referred to as a call narrative. And a literary genre oftentimes has very kind of specific set components to it. And if you would look at the call narratives in the Old Testament, many of them have these two major parts. The first one is the special revelation of God, that God appears to the person in some kind of term we use is theophany, which is God appearing himself. And God appears to the person, and then it moves. God not only appears to them, but God starts speaking with the person, very specifically calling them or commissioning them to do a specific task for God. And none of the revelations of God and the call narratives that we have are identical to each other. It's just that God in some special form reveals himself. And so, for example, when God calls Moses in Exodus chapters 3 and 4, he appears to Moses in a burning bush, a bush that is on fire and yet isn't consumed. And then when Moses gets there, God begins speaking to him and commissions him to go to Egypt to free the Israelites. Gideon, the judge, in Judges chapter 6, there it is, the angel of the Lord, which is God himself appearing in human form. He appears to Gideon, talks to him, tells him, you know, you're supposed to go fight the enemy and deliver the Israelites from the oppression which they are in. Isaiah chapter 6, as God calls Isaiah to be a prophet, Isaiah, in the first few verses, has this vision of Yahweh sitting on the throne in heaven, surrounded by the angelic beings who are declaring, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord God Almighty." And then God, in turn, commissions Isaiah to become his spokesperson or messenger, the prophet. And so Ezekiel chapters 1 through 3 follows that typical pattern, and chapter 1 is this revelation of God to Ezekiel. And then as we end the chapter and move into chapter 2, God starts speaking to Ezekiel, telling him to go and to be a prophet, messenger for God. Okay? We're only going to look at chapter 1 at this point, and in actually 3 Sundays, we'll move into chapters 2 and 3, the actual call and what he talks to Ezekiel about being a prophet and the prophetic ministry. But as we interpret in chapter 1, we do need to keep that in mind, that chapter 1 is part of a call narrative. It simply is the prelude into the commissioning of Ezekiel in chapters 2 and 3. And we can't, as we look at it, we can't completely divorce it from that. In other words, this isn't God just coming to Ezekiel, "Oh, I'm going to reveal myself to you and here I am." No, it has a specific purpose. Because in the call narrative, if you kind of think of like a job interview type thing, even though there's no interviewing going on. But one of the things that the interviewee, the one being interviewed, might want to know is, what kind of company am I working for? What is your reputation? Who are you? That kind of thing. And that's really part of the purpose of God revealing himself. God is saying, this is who you're going to be working for, and declaring things about himself so that the person, when they are called to do the task, they know who they're working for. Okay. The other thing is, we do need to keep in mind, this is a vision. Okay. It begins, "The heavens were opened, and I saw visions of God." In other words, this is a vision. This is not something which he physically saw. In other words, had you been standing by Ezekiel, you would not have seen any of this. Okay? This is in the context of a vision. Okay? And the whole main point, again, is that it is a revelation or theophany of Yahweh, because as chapter 1 ends, Ezekiel says, such was the appearance of the likeness of the glory of God. In other words, God, the purpose of this part of it is God is revealing himself to Ezekiel. I'm going to come back to both of those points in just a second, okay? That's the reason that I stress those two points, that it's a vision and the purpose is the revelation of God. The other thing about the vision is that we do need to understand the imagery within the theological and conceptual concept of both Ezekiel's Israelite culture. As the vision begins, he sees a storm approaching in which there is lightning and fire. And as he describes the throne chariot, there too there is lightning. And one of the key concepts is this brightness or illumination of all of this. All of that within the Israelite context, because how does God often reveal himself within an Israelite context? When God appeared on the top of Mount Sinai to form the covenant in Exodus, how did they visually see God? It's a storm cloud. In Exodus, God was smoking. Okay. But the storm cloud with fire and lightning, even the burning bush, you know, it is fire, and fire in lightning, storm clouds, all of that, thunder, earthquakes, all of that are very frequently associated with revelations of God himself in the Israelite culture. And so we need to understand that part of it. But the other part is we also have to understand Ezekiel's vision in the broader ancient Near Eastern context of how they pictorially represented their deities and the cosmic realm. Okay, and again, I'm going to come back to that as well. We need to keep those four things in mind as we are looking at Ezekiel chapter 1 today. Part of that I emphasize because there is on the internet and that very popularly this conception that what Ezekiel saw was a spaceship.
Chariots of the gods.
Right, yeah. There's two key three theological difficulties with it. The first thing is, oftentimes those people deny that this is a vision. They assume this is what Ezekiel actually physically saw. So they deny the fact that it's a vision. And the other thing is, for those who take that he sees a spaceship, the point of the whole thing is he sees aliens, spaceships. In other words, that whole theological point of the book, or chapter 1, that he sees the glory of Yahweh, the glory of the Lord, that God himself is revealing himself to Ezekiel, is completely denied in this spaceship interpretation of Ezekiel chapter 1. He's not seeing God. He's seeing alien beings from another planet. And so to me, that whole interpretation goes directly against the primary theology of Ezekiel chapter 1. And the other thing about it is that in no way is trying to read this in the context of ancient Near Eastern pictorial representation, or it's not even trying to get into Ezekiel's mindset of saying, well, what was Ezekiel describing? Okay? And so if you run across that, there really is no credibility to that perspective that he was seeing aliens or spaceships. Okay? Simply in his description in chapter 1, and I'm not going to read the whole thing, just kind of talk about it here, but Recognizing that Ezekiel kind of moves from, it's almost like when he sees the storm, his eyes are, you know, almost downward, like he's almost bowing, but he isn't bowing, but I mean, but he starts first describing the storm cloud and the lightning and the fire which he sees. And then it's kind of like he lifts his eyes a little bit higher and suddenly he sees these living creatures, which in later chapter 10, he actually calls them cherubim. He doesn't call them cherubim in chapter 1, but later he does. Because he sees these creatures two other times later on, chapters 10 and 11, and then also in chapters 40 and following. So I'll talk about that later. Actually, this vision ties the whole book of Ezekiel together with the repetition of the visions that he has later. But he sees these living creatures, which are composite beings, you know, four faces and wings, and but yet feet of a calf, and, you know, these weird composite creatures. Then he describes the wheels, which are next to the creatures. Goes back to describing the creatures, but then it's like he raises his eyes a little bit more and realizes that above the creatures is this thing which is called an expanse. Okay? Depending on the translation, expanse, firmament, vault. The key thing is, this is the same term that is used in Genesis chapter 1. That when God separates the waters below from the waters above, he creates this firmament and puts the firmament in between them, and he calls the firmament in Genesis 1 skies or heavens. Okay? And it's the identical term. Okay? And that's key to understanding what he's seeing here. But then he kind of lifts his eyes up higher, and above this expanse, he sees a throne. And very briefly describes that, but then seated on the throne, he sees something which is like a human being. Okay, a human-like figure seated on the throne. So the vision description does go kind of from down below, and he keeps looking up higher and higher. And then concludes, and this was the appearance of the glory of Yahweh to me. The other thing characteristic of the vision, as you read through it, you will recognize very frequently he never says, I saw this. He says, I saw something that looked like this. Okay. And that's not that he's not sure what he sees, it's just that he does not want to identify it specifically as what he is using to describe it. Okay. So it's something like, but it's not actually that thing. It simply looks like it, and this is kind of saying this is kind of the best way I can describe it by something that I know, and I'm saying it's looking like that thing. Okay? Yeah. Now, with respect to the description, we really have no problems kind of with the throne, the human-like figure, and the storm cloud. Our difficulty in kind of understanding what Ezekiel saw really deals with these living composite creatures which he sees, and the wheels. So it's really this part here that is really weird and strange, and to us maybe difficult to understand, okay? And if you kind of look at, you know, pictures or depictions as people have tried to draw this, these are just some, and that's the composite creatures with the wheels down below, and yeah. So... Okay.
Like, is that recently done, or is that like from Middle Ages, or?
No, these are all modern depictions. Modern artists or modern attempts
like
to
Christian
depict
artists?
It. Pardon?
Christian artists.
Most of them either Christian or Jewish.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, this whole chapter in Jewish mysticism takes on a whole another significance within the Jewish mystic, Kabbalistic movement as well. But what do you kind of notice about all of these representations? And I would say, actually, I was on the on the internet this morning looking at more images as well about it's kind of. Represents probably about 80% of kind of the way in which chapter one is depicted. But do you notice anything about them?
Well, there's a bird,
Yeah, this is the four faces.
Yeah.
But from an artistic standpoint, all of these are very realistic. In the sense, a real human face. A real eagle face, a real lion face, and the other is the ox. Real faces. In other words, as we view it, we often view it in terms of our almost, I would say, it's kind of a photographic, realistic imagery that we try to depict it.
These would all have correlates in Assyrian and Babylonian and Sumerian art.
Right.
Going
and
back 2,000 years.
Right. Before. And that's my point.
Yeah.
But when we think of it, when we read the text, we simply read it from our own modern concept or perspective of art rather than putting ourselves back into Ezekiel's context. Okay. And the other difficulty is with the wheels. He sees a wheel within a wheel. What does that mean? And so some have suggested it's more like this, or even like a ball that you have on the bottom of furniture that can move any which direction type thing. And others have suggested, no, the wheel within the wheel is simply you have, a spoked wheel in which, so you've got a wheel within another wheel. Okay. And then the other difficulty is with how to portray the eyes, that the wheel in chapter 1 is covered with eyes. Later on in chapter 10, it is also that the cherubim are covered with eyes as well. And so, how do we read those kind of things? Okay.
So the whole notion of vision has obviously changed over history. That is, we have divorced vision from reality so far that it is more like dreams than anything else. Whereas I wonder, did they see vision simply as another way of knowing?
Yes, they would have. For prophets frequently would have visions. And visions are differentiated in prophetic literature from dreams.
Mm-hmm.
That visions can occur in a dream. But usually a vision occurs while you are in an awake state of mind.
Okay.
And you simply have a vision as opposed to dreams which occur while you're sleeping. Okay? And there's similarity between visions and dreams, although visions seem to be, from a scriptural description, vision seems to be more... how do I say this? More accurate or more... In other words, like our dreams kind of are sometimes very fuzzy and you wake up and you can't remember them and that type of thing. Whereas visions are the type of thing, there's a real clarity to it, and when the person comes out of the vision, they can very clearly remember everything which they saw. in the vision. And again, dreams and visions. Visions are, like I said, the person is normally in an awake state and God gives the vision. The difference between the vision and physical reality is the vision is simply seen internally by the spiritual eyes, not as an external reality. So like I said, when Ezekiel sees this, had you been standing by Ezekiel, you wouldn't have seen anything.
Yeah. Yeah.
But he does, and in his mind, God gives him this.
Yeah. But the visions appear to have almost the same power in terms of giving direction as physical, as a physical sighting.
Yes. Yeah. And a vision would have been, as you experienced a vision, it would have been a very real experience, mm-hmm. just like a physical experience. Yeah. Except it's not physically happening. Yeah.
So when Joseph had his dreams in Egypt, like that wouldn't be similar?
It would be similar, but again, Joseph has dreams.
I know, yes.
Right.
But what I was thinking about was that the dreams used things that were familiar to him.
Right.
And I think that the difficulty lies here is that it's like, I mean, if you could imagine, well, I don't know. Let's say you were born 2,000 years ago and you were suddenly transported into the future, like right now.
Right.
And you had to describe to your peers what you saw. And so you would try and put that into the context of what they could understand back then. But you wouldn't necessarily, like you'd see cars moving and you wouldn't have a clue what...
I understand what you're saying. My difficulty with is the premise that they were transported into the future and saw things in the future.
No, hold on. What I'm saying is if you were and you had to describe what you saw, like something that didn't have any that was out of your normal context, you're trying to describe it to people in a way that they can understand.
Right.
But you don't know what it is that you're seeing because it's so far beyond you, and I think that's part of it.
Right, I agree with that. But again, like I said, to me, the prophets are never transported into the distant future.
I'm not saying it's not transported.
Yeah. The prophets are not seeing things which are specifically distant future. So that when God shows them things, He is using images and symbolism and realities which they will understand. He's showing them things within their own cultural context.
Because we're not from that culture.
Exactly. We don't understand it because we are different from that culture.
So how he described it would have been more, the people of his time would have understood it a little better.
Yes.
He would have used stuff that they would have gotten.
Right.
Whereas we're looking back at it now from our perspective and we don't have any cultural context, so we don't understand the whole.
That's the issue. We don't understand it because we live in a different cultural context.
Exactly.
Just a couple of things interpreting this. There is a difficulty in only using words to describe a visual image. For example, Ezekiel has seen something visual. He has to take that vision, which he has seen, which is a pictorial image in his mind, and he has to now communicate that through words. And there is an inherent difficulty in doing that. If I have a picture in my mind and I simply try to describe that picture to you, to recreate that same picture in your mind, there is an inherent difficulty with that. Now, if I have a picture in my mind and I can take a picture of it and show you the picture, then you will get exactly what I have in my mind. But words, it's just an inherent difficulty in not just describing visions, but trying to describe any picture. You know, go to an art gallery and see a picture, and then go to your friend and try to describe that picture and have them recreate that picture in their mind. There's a difficulty there. Okay? Again, there's also a level of difficulty in describing a vision which may not have the clarity of seeing something in reality. Here again, it is especially more with dreams. Try to tell somebody a dream which you had and create in their mind the exact image of the dream that you had, because again, dreams are inherently, and visions I think, are inherently not always realistic. Okay? And I had a dream the other night where I was visiting a friend and they had a couple of pet black bears, and I was trying to leave and the black bears kept grabbing my arm. Okay. Now you can get an image of that, but the image of that that you have won't be quite the same as the actual dream that I had. So keep that in mind. Okay. The other thing is, we already mentioned this, our difficulty in visualizing a description from this ancient Near Eastern context of using the term iconography. Iconography is the way in which they would depict their gods, deities, cosmic realm, kings, kings, and all of that. How they would create statues and that type of thing. Rather than our modern culture, which is a more very realistic photograph perspective. And I pointed that out when I showed you the pictures. All of those modern depictions of the cherubim are more like photographs, very realistic. So it's a human face, it's a human ox face, it's a human lion, or not a human, a realistic lion face. You know, we almost read the vision like we see modern day photographs, rather than what was kind of in Ezekiel's mind. Now, I'm going to give you a description here, and I want you to mentally picture these things, okay? When I approached the temple, I saw a monkey who was standing upright, and he was covered in gold, and in his hand was a staff that reached to the ground. On the back of his calves were something like small wings, and the end of his tail also he had something like a wing. He had jewelry bracelets on his legs and arms, and a waist satch which was also covered with jewels. And on his head was something like a helmet with a long spike on the top, and his ears were like Vulcan ears. Star Trek Vulcan ears, okay? Next to him was another monkey, similar to the first, but this one was white, and his body was covered with something like yellow and orange spirals. He had four large sharp teeth, four on the top, two on the bottom. His lips were red and green. He had large eyes like circles, concentric circles of dark blue and light blue, and his ears were green, yellow, and red stripes covered with jewels. There was also another creature, a lion, all bronze in color. He too had spirals all over his body and something like four small wings on his back and one at the end of his tail and a very pointed nose.
Is it something that you actually saw? Or?
Now, can you get that image in your mind?
No.
Image of these three creatures?
I think it's a Hindu temple or something. That's what I'll...
Now, is that what you pictured in your mind?
No.
Now, okay, and the descriptions are very accurate, right? But unless I tell you that the context of this is a temple in Thailand.
Okay. I wasn't too far off.
Yeah. If you don't have that context, okay, he's describing these guardian monkeys and lions from a temple in Thailand. The images which you come up with are going to be very different than what the words describe. Now, do the words actually describe what is there? Yes, they do. But you have to recognize the context of the description. And realize, you know, these are monkeys, and yet to a degree they look kind of like real monkeys, but not really. So you have to recognize, in the Buddhist artwork of Thailand, these things are very stylized. They're not realistic, especially the lion. The lion is stylized. It's not a realistic-looking lion. Okay? If you know the context of, these are temples in Thailand where they have all of these types of, even the elephants. Yeah, they look like elephants, but... the guardian monkeys around the temple, the birds, the snakes, and all of that. Unless you realize the context, you're never going to get the right concept of the imagery. Similarly, I suggest the same is true for Ezekiel. We need to be looking at what did ancient Near Eastern art represent? Representation look like. And so this is where in ancient Near Eastern art you have composite creatures made up of several different animals. So like this is a guardian at a temple, but it's got a human face, but it's got calves, legs, but it's got wings.
Is that from Babylon? Or?
Another one, this one has a lion face with wings, but also two heads. It's got a human head on it as well. This is Persian in nature, so you've got a lion. That might actually be a goat or a ram. Or it's a lion with horns, but it's got wings and... If the feet are clearly lion's feet. In other words, composite creatures. It's part of the common world in which Ezekiel lived. That's the way they depicted things, was the use of composite creatures. Here we have, the bird head, the wings, but note it's got human hands, it's got human feet. Similarly, the other one, the bird head, but again, human feet, human hands.
A lot of their gods were like that. Were they depicted like that?
They depicted their gods like that. They depicted the guardians of the gods.
Like Egyptian.
Even the kings are depicted sometimes in composite. Egyptian art is very similar. You could put Egyptian art up here as well, and it would be the same type of composite creatures. That's an Egyptian one. So you have something with a goat head, but human feet, but wings, human arms to the wings. So this whole thing of composite creatures, it's strange to us. But in the ancient Near Eastern context in which Ezekiel lived, it is a very common depiction of the cosmic realm. Even multi-faced depictions. We would say, Ezekiel's cherubim have four faces. That's strange. Well, part of that is in when you're doing sculpture art, you have a face on each side, so it doesn't matter where in the sculpture you are, the statue is always looking at you. Okay? Again, this one here is Egyptian. This is actually a representation of one of the four directions of the that the wind blows. So four faces, but they're goat faces, but the goat has wings. Again, depiction of the sun and that type of thing and the winds. There's another one over there with four faces on it. And the other thing that these composite creatures are very often associated with being guardians of the king. And so they're actually depicted on the sides of the thrones of the kings. So here you have this composite creature, you know, a human face, but wings, but lion feet. And it is actually part of the base of the throne as part of the guardian of the king. Another one over here is similar to that, with the human face, but the wings and like lion feet. Here's another one, is from Hittite culture, but you have the lions, which are at the base of the throne of the king as guards, but then in the middle you have again this composite creature with an eagle or vulture head, but a human body to it. And a couple of other, these are Assyrian, but down here you have the composite creatures again, human face, wings. That one looks like a chicken. But then something else which is part of the throne of these people down here who are holding up the throne. Very common in ancient Near Eastern art, these are referred to as sky bearers. They are the ones who carry, frequently depicted as carrying the gods or carrying the sky. Okay? And you can see the depictions, and they too are all composite creatures, you know, with wings, but human characteristics, animal characteristics to them. And it's interesting in the ancient Assyrian art that you have lion sky bearers that have lion's faces, ox faces, eagle, or we refer to it as an eagle, and everybody thinks of the bald eagle, but probably it is in that cultural context. It's actually a vulture, a type of vulture, not an eagle like we think of eagle. You look at all of the Egyptian art, they have vultures. It's a type of vulture, okay? Eagles were not that common a bird over in the ancient Near East, but vultures were, okay? And another one with a human face. And so what do these represent? Because that's the four faces which Ezekiel sees on the cherubim. So what do they represent? I know the early Christian church says these are the four Gospels, mm-hmm. Matthew, Mark, Luke, and John, represented by each of these creatures.
So are they associated with the temple?
In fact, in Solomon's temple, there are cherubim on the curtains and that, which were probably these composite-type creatures as well. And so even seeing the cherubim isn't simply coming from ancient Near Eastern context. It's coming from his own Israelite background as a priest. But just to stop to think, who is the lion?
The Lion of Judah?
Well,
I don't know.
We refer to the lion as what?
Oh, great.
The ruler.
King of the beasts. Doesn't the lion symbolize the king of the wild, non-domesticated beasts? Okay, so what's an ox in that culture? The ox is the king of domesticated animals. What is the eagle or the vulture?
King of the air.
King of the birds and humans. In other words, if you stop to think about this, all these faces represent are the four divisions of animal creation in the sky and land. Now fish are left out for a particular reason, because the sea is a symbol of chaos. Okay? But what does God, you know, Genesis chapter 1, what does God create? He creates the wild beasts, he creates the domestic beasts, he creates the birds of the sky, and he creates humans. In other words, when you're talking about kind of the four realms of created beings in Genesis chapter 1, it is the lion, the ox, the eagle, and humans, representative of those four creatures. Okay. These sky bearers are also represented in ancient Near Eastern art as transporting the deities on platforms which the deities would have been carried. And so you can see all the sky bears down here. And here at the ends, you have these composite beasts. And assuming that there's probably one on each corner of that, if we could see it in a three-dimensional perspective. Okay? And we do know how were these idols of the deities carried in the ancient Near East. They were carried by four people walking along. In fact, how was the Ark of the Covenant carried? It was carried by four people with poles through it, and that's how the Ark of the Covenant was carried as well. And we also know that the deities were transported at times on wheeled chariots or carts. Okay? What about the eyes all over the thing? The term eye doesn't always have to mean literal eye. It's used in a number of ways in the Old Testament and can simply refer to something that looks like an eye. Some have suggested this is an actual Egypt representation of an Egyptian chariot. And note that it has studded wheels.
Winter tires.
Winter tires. And they actually built chariots that way so that they had traction. So are the eyes really eyes, or are they something like the wheels or studded wheels? Or another suggestion, and I would favor this one, very frequently chariots are studded with jewels, eye-shaped jewels. So when he describes the wheels having eyes, it may not be a literal eye, it may be a jewel which glitters or sparkles like an eye. In fact, Egyptian art, you go to chapter 10 I mentioned where he says that the cherubim are covered with eyes. You go to Egyptian art, and this is the winged vulture. And what is it covered with? Jewels. Now, how would you describe that? Now, we might use the term, you know, eye-shaped jewels or something like this, but it may be that it's not referring to literal eyes at all, but that these are jewel-studded beings.
We do that with a peacock's tail.
Yeah. Okay, we call the things on the, on the peacock's tail eyes. Yeah. They're not really eyes. Okay. So putting all of that into an ancient Near Eastern context, what did Ezekiel actually see? I would suggest we need to think in terms of that ancient Near Eastern iconography of the way in which they depicted things. And I would suggest it looked something more like this, but each of the creatures would have been four-headed and with wings and that type of thing. I'm not an artist, so I can't sit down and do this, but some point in my life I'm actually going to sit down with an artist and have them kind of depict this using ancient Near Eastern iconography. But looking something like that, with throw in some wings and there's fire in the midst of it. And so what is all of this simply symbolizing? Okay, you have the deity seated on the throne, which indicates the deity's rulership or sovereignty over all of creation. As I mentioned, the expanse on which she is sitting is the same word as Genesis chapter 1. Which separates that which is above, the heavenlies, from that which is below. And I suggest this expanse which Ezekiel sees is separating, he's acknowledging in one sense, that this is depicting kind of the creation realm, that God is seated in the heavenlies as he rules over creation. You have the expanse which separates the heavenlies from the earth which is below. And the beings which are carrying this, or part of the movement of it, are these cherubim, which represent the four realms of created creatures. wild beasts, domesticated beasts, birds, and humans. And so that what he's depicting is simply creation, symbolism of not only creation, but the whole spiritual realm, with the heavenlies up above and God with the sky, and then the earthly realm represented where the cherubim are down below. And to me, that makes a lot more sense, that this is kind of what he's seeing through his eyes as an ancient Israelite living in that ancient Near Eastern context or culture. And so the symbolism of it is that God, who is enthroned in heaven, moves around with this, and it is a throne chariot. And God's presence can go wherever God decides, as God is sovereignly in control over all of creation. And that his created being, creatures, are there in service of him. So that's kind of the theology in that, which I think is part of this. And so if you can kind of picture it more from an ancient Near Eastern perspective of what it might have looked like.
I'm really fascinated by the idea of the mobility, because, you know, this is in the context of a dislocated, traumatized people.
Yes.
And to have the idea that God could not be, is not just in Jerusalem.
Yes.
It's such a moving image.
Yes.
A moving in both the emotional and the sense that we don't have to be apart from God, even in this dislocation.
And that is part of the theological significance of this. For the glory of God appears in Babylon. Again, last week we talked about the popular theology, or the theology which is Ezekiel's talking to. Again, the popular theology would only have associated Yahweh with the temple in Jerusalem. That's where the glory of God is. But now this radical thing, no, the glory of God is in Babylon. The glory of God is appearing to Ezekiel in an unclean land outside of the promised land. That's radical. That God is not just with his people back in Jerusalem. God is with his people who are now in exile. And God's presence with his people in exile is just as real as his presence with people in Jerusalem at that time. And the other thing which is radical is, this whole perspective that God's presence, the glory of the Lord, was in the temple, over the Ark of the Covenant, in the temple. Once the temple was built, the glory of God became a very static, unmovable thing. It never left the temple. Previous to that, in the wilderness wanderings and all of that, and even before the temple was built, the glory of God, represented by the Ark of the Covenant, which also the Ark of the Covenant has what? It has cherubim on the top of it as well. It was the movement of the glory of God with the Ark of the Covenant which led the people through the wilderness. Whenever it moved, the people moved. Where it stopped, the people stopped. And so the glory of the Lord was theologically perceived as something which could move around from place to place with the expectation the people would remain with it. Once the temple was built, it became very static. Glory of God never left the temple. Okay? But now, suddenly, in Ezekiel's vision, you have not only its appearing in Babylon, but it is a throne chariot. By nature, it is designed to move around, to move to where the people are, or the people moving with it as it moves. And these two things are radical theological concepts which is being communicated through this throne chariot vision of the glory of God.
Is it reminiscent maybe even of Jacob's vision of the ladder between earth and heaven when he's leaving home and traveling?
Traveling, yeah. God tells him, as you leave this land, I will be with you.
Yeah, where Moses is joining with
right.
the desert.
Yeah.
And also the ambivalence mm-hmm. of building the temple at all in Jerusalem. It's not clear
right.
whether that was God's plan or not.
Right. yeah. Because Deuteronomy simply says, you will worship God at the place that I designate. Now that was later understood as, okay, the temple. But previous to that, God, at the place God designated was wherever he chose to have the tabernacle. And even yeah. prior to the tabernacle was at several different locations within Israel. The point, and yeah, and with David, the point is, God's point is, you know, I've never had a house, why do I need a house?
Yeah. Yeah.
But he does accede to David's request to have a temple built. But it does change the mobility of God or the perception of the mobility of God when you have a permanent structure.
One of the contemporary Jewish writers makes the point that God's appearance in Babylon made possible the Jewish diaspora. Without it, you could not be Jewish anywhere else.
Yeah.
But there's now the realization you can be a Jew in New York.
Wherever you are.
In Paris. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Where would the covenant of the ark be right at this point when he has the vision?
It would still have been in the temple because this is prior to the destruction of the temple.
Okay, I just wasn't sure. That
right. Yes, the temple still existed.
Okay.
It was another, 6 years before the temple was destroyed. So again, that's part of the radicalness of it. The temple is still standing. And again, then, the radicalness of this is it ties to chapter 10 and following. In chapters 10 and 11, in his vision there, he actually sees the glory of the Lord rising up from the Holy of Holies and moving out of Jerusalem. And suddenly now in chapter 1, it's in Babylon. And then in chapters 40 and following, in the vision of the temple which will be rebuilt, he sees the glory of the Lord returning from the east, returning and once again settling over this new rebuilt temple in his vision of chapters 40 through 48. So again, this whole glory of the Lord ties the whole, these three visions and the whole book actually together.
There's a strong notion of protection there too. I noticed that the deity sitting on the throne was A, movable, and secondly was holding a bow and arrow.
That one wasn't a deity, that's actually a king, representing
okay,
a king.
Okay, whatever.
The
king, the protection of God.
Yeah, and Yahweh is presented as the divine warrior
yeah.
who, again, they assumed would always fight on behalf of his people, but now he's in Ezekiel's prophecies, God is the divine warrior who is fighting against his people because they have violated his covenant through their sins. So, yeah. Any other final comments? I know we've kind of hit our time limit here.
The Ark of the Covenant was never described with any kind of wheel symbol, was it, up until this point?
No.
They carried it with animals.
Right.
So this was quite a development.
Yeah.
For sure.
That would have been more how the Ark of the Covenant was carried. It was always carried by the priests, four priests who would have carried it on poles.
Yeah. Exactly.
Right. But yes, this is the first reference to kind of the glory of God being this on a throne chariot.
But their current vehicles were for the armies were chariots.
Right.
So the development of the wheel had really come on then with
yeah.
these armies.
Yeah.
So obviously
again, if you've ever traveled to some very, very Catholic countries like Mexico or the Philippines, at their festivals, how do they, what do they do with the images of Mary? They have them on carts, and they actually wheel them through the streets of the city on carts. It's very, very similar to the imagery, how deities, the images of deities were transported in the ancient Near East on these carts or kind of four-wheeled chariots. Yeah.
Because Ezekiel's, when he says wheels, you know, and something that he could recognize in his vision would be probably chariot wheels.
Right. And I think everything which Ezekiel is describing is very understandable to him. It's part of his world view of how things were depicted. And again, our difficulty in drawing the picture from what he says is that we live in a completely different culture and forget to think about the imagery in the ancient Near Eastern context as opposed to our modern context.
He didn't see spaceships.
He didn't see
on television like we
do. No.
Yeah.
Okay. Next Sunday, Richard is going to lead the discussion because I have to be gone down to the States. But he's going to talk about, and I've actually forwarded him a little bit of material about, can we, as Christians, function prophetically within our contemporary context without actually being prophets? Okay? And then the following Sunday is Thanksgiving weekend, so there is no Sunday school class, so I will be back here again in 3 weeks, and we'll continue talking about chapters 2 and 3, the rest of Ezekiel's call. Because interesting dynamics there that God says to Ezekiel, your task isn't going to be easy at all. In fact, nobody's going to listen to you. How would you like to be called to ministry if God tells you absolutely nobody will listen? Okay? So go with God's blessing through the rest of the day here.